And so now here we can discuss the results. So the full symbols, the circles basically are the C2 even and odd levels of our numerical approaches, and the empty squares with the two colors are the predictions from the epsilon expansion for the Ising CFT. And so now you can see that basically each time there is like a filled symbol, there's also an empty square close by and vice versa. So the agreement, at least for our taste, is quite good, because as we will see later when we compare different theories, it's not so much the individual values which are important, it seems right now at this stage, but it's more where are levels and where are none. Okay.
Andreas, yeah? I don't understand what lowest non-trivial order means in practice for epsilon, but you're saying you take epsilon equal to 1.
Yes.
And so how is that the lowest non-trivial order in epsilon already gives you such a remarkable match?
Yeah, I think part of the answer is that the zero mode has to be taken out and solved non-perturbatively. That's kind of already too, within some subset of the problem, that's like non-perturbative. And it's not a very convincing answer, but there's some aspect to it. It's like there's an effective Hamiltonian coming in the leading order in epsilon, but that problem you have to solve non-perturbatively, so you actually have to solve the kind of the strongly anharmonic oscillator numerically, and so that's something other people have done to high precision. So you can use those results and somehow take these values, and then they will kind of combine and give you this. But indeed, it's a question what happens to if you go to higher order. It could even be worse. No, I think people doing epsilon expansion in field theory know that some of these expansions are only asymptotic. So you can sum up to some orders, results get better, and you add more, then they get worse, and you have to somehow do Borel summation and things like that. So I think it's, at least I have no idea how well conditioned this series is in epsilon. This is just the leading order result. It's already quite a non-trivial calculation.
You're saying that they call it the next order and then...
No, I think probably not. But I think what is useful is that this actually, the zero mode idea gives you an understanding of what, if you go, for example, to Gros-Neveu or some other theory, and you want to have like a basic understanding what to expect, then it might be a good intuition to think about zero modes which strongly interact with each other. So that this could be like a first guess of what to expect. Like if you have massless fermions, you have massless bosons, okay, they will be strongly coupled. You have to solve that problem first, and then you get the first idea of what the theory might be if you have some other degrees of freedom. Okay? Yeah. And so... So these are now kind of our results for the Ising CFT for torus spectra and these two different modular parameters. And just as a reference, you can do, since we kind of know from conformal bootstrap by now very precisely what are the scaling dimensions of the two relevant fields in the Ising CFT, we can actually just take their results and somehow pretend to plot the numerical spectrum. If we were able to quantize the theory on the surface of a sphere, what would the energy spectrum look like? So the natural variables on the sphere would be angular momentum. So that's like what we would plot here, and so here I plot kind of this spectrum here. Kind of which is what the guess of how that spectrum would look like. So it would also be like the low-lying mode at zero, because these are scalars, so they are at zero angle momentum, and then we would expect to their energy to increase if you go to finite momentum. And these are like the descendants of these levels. There's also a stress energy tensor at scaling dimension 3. There's the first kind of irrelevant C2 even field epsilon prime and so on. And we're just saying what is kind of interesting is that here there seems to be like a similar succession of the vacuum. Then there's something like the C2 odd field, which is on the sphere is really the sigma field. And so we somehow think there's some kind of a doppelganger or a similar level on the torus, which mimics the sigma field on the sphere. And also this we think is like a doppelganger of the epsilon field on the torus. So I think there's no exact relation, so we're not saying this is kind of state operator correspondent, but it's still remarkable that in these units where the speed of light has been taken out, has been determined and used so such that this is really C equal kind of velocity one. There seems to be some rough agreement between the location of this field. Again, we don't think this is exact, so we cannot read off the scaling dimension by measuring this value. But it's still, if you want to have some zero order guess where we should expect this field, it seems like the values of the sphere give you a first intuition what you would expect to show up in your torus spectrum as well.
How is the speed of light determined in numerics?
Yeah, using quantum Monte Carlo, we can actually calculate this, for example, the dispersion of this field here up to very high up, and then we can actually fit this, and then we get numbers, and we can put that to one.
Sorry?
Yes?
But would you expect this to hold in more complicated theories where you have gauge fields? Because there you would expect to have light holonomies, which would not be present in the sphere. So you would expect much more lighter states, for instance, on a torus than on a sphere.
Yeah, I don't have a working intuition in my head on gauge theories in this setting, so it would be interesting to know what could go wrong. But at least in these systems, without any kind of strange things, it seems to work nicely. So we have some preliminary work on Gros-Neveu theories, where we have kind of massless Dirac fermions. And then actually we also realized that the fact that we're on a torus gives rise to zero modes, which I think are not there on the sphere. And that seems to complicate a bit. So indeed, it might be that for these simple, I mean, even though they're strongly interacting theories, they're still kind of simple. It might seem here it works nicely, but indeed there could be challenges by going to more complicated theories. And it would be interesting to explore that in more detail. Okay, and so so that was like the C2 spectrum. And so that's basically a kind of a quantitative representation. So what we did here, is now we also have results for microscopic models in the O2 universality class and in the O3. And so there is corresponding epsilon expansion results as well. And so what we do here is just to compare these different theories. And so there are two points to be made. So first of all is for example, if you compare the spectrum between the Ising theory, which we did in quite a bit of detail now, and the O2 theory, for example, you see that the succession of levels in terms of multiplet structure is that there's a vacuum, which is obviously unique. But then in the XY model or in the O2 theory, and the first level here, the spin field is actually already a multiplet, so it's twofold degenerate. And then there's another twofold degenerate level before the first singlet, so state which is non-degenerate, appears again. And so in the torus spectrum, something which I insisted now several times is that if you want to discriminate between Ising and XY, in case you would encounter such a situation, the point is not so much that you should differentiate what is the energy level of these yellow or orange levels with respect to each other. That might be hard to differentiate. But the thing which differentiates them is that here there's a green level, which is twofold degenerate, which is not there in the Ising. So that's like the power of the spectrum. It's not so much the fine numbers at this stage, which are kind of super important to get right, but it's the fact that the Ising theory has another kind of a spin 2 or an angular momentum L equals 2 level, which is below the first kind of something like the epsilon doppelganger, which is there, which is not there in the other theory. So that's like what makes this method kind of powerful, is that there are multiplets there or they're not there in different theories, and it's not so much the values for individual levels, which are important at this stage. And I just want to say also is that here you can see we took the liberty to also show the scaling dimensions again on the sphere. So these are these half empty symbols. And we normalize all the methods and all results such that the epsilon field or the doppelganger is at one. And then you can still see that these things kind of more or less nicely cluster together, at least in the low energy part. This seems to at least be roughly the case, even though there's no fundamental understanding of why this is the case, but it's an interesting observation, at least to develop a kind of an approximate intuition of what's happening. Okay, and so now we want to kind of stay with the same kind of fundamental theory, but we look at a different microscopical or physical scenario, which is the so-called C2 confinement transition. And in the literature, this has been called an Ising star transition. And we're going to tell you in what sense that's different from an Ising theory. So what we what is the physical scenario? In contrast, the symmetry breaking transition was which we looked at so far, was a transition from a complete paramagnet with a unique ground state to a C2 symmetry broken phase where you have spontaneous magnetic order. Now there are other types of states of matter, for example, these C2 spin liquids, which can be, for example, be obtained in the toric coat model, which Kitaev introduced. And so there is one phase, which is the C2 topological phase, which has a fourfold ground state degeneracy, which is closely related to the fact that you're on a torus. And so that's like a gapped state of matter, but with a topological ground state degeneracy, and the excitation, some of it have anionic statistics. Now, what you can have is that you can start putting a perturbation on this topological phase, and so there's a microscopic way to perturb that. And if you perturb enough, then this topological phase breaks down. There's a quantum phase transition to a trivial phase. And so this transition is a transition from the deconfined, so the topological phase, to a confined phase, which is an exotic word, but in the microscopic setting, it just means we're going to the paramagnetic phase. And so this is a confinement transition, and theoretical arguments tell you that this should also be a 3D Ising universality class. And so the question you can ask now is whether the torus spectrum at criticality now is identical to what we have just observed. And since I'm devoting a chapter to this, it will turn out that's not the case. So here is just a quick reminder of the model we're looking at. So I guess many of you have seen it. So it's the toric coat. So we have these star and plaquette coupling terms. And the perturbation we put on top, which is beyond, which makes this problem kind of not exactly solvable, is that we put the magnetic field H, which couples to the sigma X degree of freedom. So if H is zero, this is a toric coat. You know the exact wave functions and so on. But by putting in H, you start to perturb the problem. And something which we're going to use later, but I'm not going to discuss it in a lot of detail now, is that people have actually figured out that if you start with this perturbation, you can somehow map this problem exactly onto a transverse field Ising model in some kind of new variables, which are these mu variables, which are the values of these B plaquette terms, which you can locate at the centers of plaquettes. So it's like there are virtual degrees of freedom, which we call mu, which live at the center, and you can write this perturbation here. Then comes kind of like the Ising coupling of a new transverse field model, which lives on the plaquette, where the degrees of freedom are the plaquette variable of your toric coat. And what is also interesting, what's going to show up, is that the boundary condition which this transverse field Ising model enjoys are actually the values of these loop operators, which you might know in the toric coat. The toric coat has these conserved quantities, which are values of this chain of products of spins across the non-trivial contraction loops around the torus directions, T1 and T2. And so if you choose such a sector, this will actually impose you some type of boundary condition in your Ising models in this new variable. And there will be something interesting in the spectrum which has to do with that. But OK, so now these are now the results which you should know by now from the symmetry breaking torus spectrum for the square torus. And these are now spectra for the toric coat at its critical point, which we're looking at. And the point is, without going into details, that the spectrum do not match at all. No. So here there are a bunch of levels at low energy, whereas here this is alone and there's a single state higher up. Here there are together four states. So that's like the remnants of this fourfold ground state degeneracy. They show up here. Then there's this level here, which seems to be the same. But then this level and these, they seem to be missing. And then there are a lot of other levels higher up. And so these spectra do not agree. And the question is, why not? And kind of the simple answer is that the answer is basically that the partition function of your field theory, which you have realized in that particular phase transition, is not the same as the one which you had in the symmetry breaking transition. So it's still something which comes from the same underlying CFT. It's still the Ising CFT, but you assemble different sectors in one partition function in the toric coat phase transition, and you're having a different partition function in the symmetry breaking transition. So they're both kind of derived from the same underlying CFT, but there are different partition functions. And so we can call that, say that the operator content in these two transitions are different. So if there's the symmetry breaking case, we have the C2 global spin C2 even and odd levels, but only one set of boundary conditions of the field theory. These are the ones fixed by the lattice model, and since we're usually using plain vanilla periodic boundary conditions, the field theory also has the same boundary conditions. But now in this confinement transition, in this what we call Ising star, we only have the C2 even sector, so the C2 odd is actually absent here. But on the other hand, we have all we basically inherit four different boundary conditions of the CFT simultaneously apparent on a single torus, and this has to do with this kind of the fact that the values of the different loop which you have in the deep in the topological ordered phase, they become soft states also at criticality, and they correspond to basically the torus spectrum, where the torus in the CFT has like periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions in the two spatial direction. And so that's something which you can see them. So that's now like we also have epsilon expansion results. You can also calculate the epsilon expansion in these different sectors. And so, for example, to make it simple, the explanation of why we have these four states here, these are basically kind of the lowest levels of the even sector of the Ising CFT. If you combine both the periodic-periodic case, which we have already seen, but also the two-fold degenerate antiperiodic-periodic, and there are two ways to do that on the torus. You do one antiperiodic-periodic, the other one. There are two choices. And there's also one state which is antiperiodic in both directions, and they actually make up these four different states. So one, a doublet, and one, these together makes these four states, and so that's what we see here. And so there are other levels which also come always in with four different boundary condition sets. And so we see that the torus spectrum still derives from the Ising CFT, but it's like a different partition function. And that's the reason why we call this transition merits a different name, which is the Ising star transition, because it's like a different partition function. Okay.
When you say different partition function. Is that the same as saying different boundary conditions on the?
Yeah, it's like the sum over all four boundary conditions, but in the Ising you delete, I mean the Ising has like the C2 even and odd sectors, so you delete the C2 odd, so that's one. But then you take the sum over all four boundary condition choices, so that's what I would call is then the partition function of this Ising star theory. Okay, so I think since I'm a bit running short on time, I'm going to skip this XY star case. But the point is, here in this spectroscopy, we have a microscopic model, and we can actually see that that in some regime of parameter space, we can discuss that in private if you want, but the point is, by doing ED spectroscopy, we're actually able to see that this microscopic model like has a spectrum which is actually in quite close agreement with the prediction from the XY universality class, even though the microscopic model does not enjoy O2 invariance. And so the spectroscopy reveals that, I think, to a quite a good degree. And it's clearly different from two copies of Ising. So you can see how the spectra evolve into this XY-like. And we can also, there's a similar from XY, you can also generate an XY star kind of partition function by deleting some sectors, but integrating over four different boundary condition choices. And so the spectrum then becomes quite wild, but we can understand it, how it is actually constructed. Okay, and now I come to the outlook. So we have looked at microscopic lattice models, but there's also the hope that in the future we can actually take like really CFT field theories directly in continuum space, but truncate them, for example, in the Hilbert space by cutting off the Hilbert space at finite energy of a starting point. And so these are some results which we're along these lines by a paper by Richkov and Vitali, where they do this in 1+1D. So we have refined that a little bit and also start looking at 2+1 dimensional. So these are not lattice models, but continuum field theories, at least simple ones, where we truncate the Hilbert space. So in 2+1D, there are some issues with the kind of divergences which one has to control, but that might be something which one can handle, hopefully. Another direction is also that we're looking at this Gross-Neveu-Yukawa theory. So there are some preliminary results for low-lying spectrum at criticality for some Gross-Neveu-Yukawa with a certain type number of fermion flavors. And so these are things which can also be looked at. And then I come to the conclusion. And so I hope I have convinced you that the torus energy spectrum is kind of universal, depends only on the modular parameter of the torus. And therefore, it's like a fingerprint of this of the quantum critical point. And so the torus energy spectrum, we think, contains information on the operator content in a broad sense. It's able to discriminate the Ising from the Ising star universality class, for example, and also, say, two copies of Ising from the 3DXY and so on. And so also we have results for Wilson-Fisher and for Gross-Neveu-Yukawa, and we think that that might be a useful kind of a first preliminary catalog of relatively simple quantum field theories. And so if we're going to explore kind of unknown microscopic models and we suspect there's an Ising transition, now there's like a prediction of what the torus spectrum for an Ising transition should look like. And then we can confront in a new microscopic model whether the low-lying energy spectrum is in agreement with what the field theoretical prediction is. And over the time, we would also be nice to develop similar predictions, say, for example, for some versions of QED3, in order to check some of the spin liquid or deconfined quantum phase transitions. And it would also be interesting if somehow the quantum field theory or CFT side would have tools to predict or to derive torus energy spectrum for different shape parameters. This I would like to thank the collaborators, so Michael Schuler, PhD student in our group, and Louis-Paul Henry did the numerics. And on the analytical side, we had great support by Subir Sajdev and Seth Witzetz, his PhD student on the epsilon expansions. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Said about how these energy levels should behave under modular transformations of the torus.
Well, that's a question which we get asked quite a bit. I mean, there are some simple transformations, like, for example, if we have a square torus, it basically means that if you exchange the two cycles, it should be the same. But that's like a microscopic lattice symmetry, so that's justified because these levels actually are symmetric. Yeah, and so it's a consistency check, but it's kind of almost for free. Other modular transform that you, because in a stat mech or in a 3D space-time picture, we're looking at a geometry which has like a square, which is finite, and which is a very long slab in the third direction. So it could be that if you have a different setup where you're looking at transfer matrices of a system at finite temperature, infinitely long in one spatial direction and finite in another one, then I guess the transfer matrix in some direction should also have the same spectrum. But that's something which, at least right now, I wouldn't know how to calculate that. With Monte Carlo, one can probably look at that, like the spectrum of correlation length along the long direction, but that's like a different computational setup. One could do that.
But for instance, T-transformations, you cannot say anything
about it? No, I think it's a bit, I mean, it's perhaps something which is worth looking into more detail, but it's not so obvious on the lattice how to do this transformation, because at least in most of these calculations, we work with a lattice, and then it's not so clear to me how to do that. Yeah?
The spectrum of your Ising star, is it just four times the spectrum of, I mean, four copies of the Ising spectrum, or...?
Yes, but each copy like is with different boundary conditions, so it's different. Like, or I mean, two are the same because they are just flipped versions of it. But it's like four different boundary condition sets.
Specific boundary conditions. If you just projected Ising star to any particular boundary condition, you would have gotten Ising, right?
Yeah.
Just checking.
But it is a transformation, right?
Yeah, that's why I expect that. I just wasn't sure if I was reading the graphs correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing this for 3D, you can deal with 40 qubits, 50 qubits, so or spins. So can you do 4D? three special dimension. Is that already the right time to start thinking about this, or?
Yeah, perhaps not. I mean, for a transfer sizing model, one could probably do it, but.
But if there is some universality aspect to it, you would already be able to scale like linear size 2, 3, 4.
I mean, with exactization, you would typically look at various like parallel epipeds or something like in three dimensions. So you would still have, a range of samples, but it might be hard. I mean, it might just be that L is so short compared to the lattice scale that at some point, this might probably not work with the quality desired. And also, at least for the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, like 4 is also the upper critical dimension. So you're somehow putting a lot of effort to somehow confirm that this spectrum is kind of close to mean field theory plus Gaussian correction. So it's not, I mean, kind of it's known what to expect there.
For all possible microscopic systems that are critical?
No, for the Wilson-Fischer fixed point.
For that particular one?
Yeah.
So then, you know, you keep saying you did this with 40 spins, but every time I use my laptop and I try to do 24 spins, something goes wrong, and 26 is already too much. So what am I doing wrong? And in relation to that, so over the last, I don't know, if I had asked you 10 years ago how many spins you can do, and if I ask you today how many spins you can do, there has been a substantial improvement. So are we expected to be able to do more and more spins?
As long as Moore's law keeps scaling, you can add a few qubits more every 10 years or so. No?
10 years, few qubits more.
Yes, yeah. It's exponentially scaling. So I guess if you bring your tensor networks up to speed in 2+1 dimensions, then you can somehow calculate similarly energy spectra. I mean, that's you don't need the technology.
No, but it's
the ED technology. You can replace that with other methods which are able to calculate the low energy spectrum.
Nowadays you can do 50 spin, right?
Yeah.
Up to 50.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 years ago,
we did like 40 or something.
Okay, so it's a substantial number.
Yeah. So in 10 or 15 years, perhaps we can do 60, but not the 100.
I have a question. In an earlier talk, you mentioned that this connection between the rescaling circuit and time translation circuit only held in the case of the sphere, not the dwarf.
Yeah.
So you have no reason theoretically to expect this correspondence that ultimately numerics find. So do you sort of retrospectively have a theoretical understanding of why there's this connection?
No, it seems that it's actually quite controversial, because I think really from a field theoretical point of view, the torus, I mean, that it has a spectrum, which is kind of a property of the CFT, I think this is accepted. But as we had one of the questions, I think there are many cases that there might even be arguments that the torus spectrum should be quite different than what you have on the sphere. So it might be that somehow we were lucky so far that the CFTs we looked at were somehow sufficiently well behaved that nothing would go wrong as you go from the sphere to the torus. But there are field theories where, for example, as we said, there can be zero modes, or perhaps if you look at gauge theories, there are things happening on the torus which can be soft, which do not happen on the sphere, and so that. But you might need gauge theories or fermions in order to have that. And since these were basically only bosonic theories without gauge fields, they might be sufficiently well behaved that this analogy works nicely. But there might be wilder theories, more complicated ones, where this analogy is going to break down. But it's still the case that for a certain theory, the torus spectrum is kind of a property of the field theory, and like having a catalog of what the torus spectrum of a field theory looks like is still interesting and still serves the purpose. And whether it has immediately or a loose connection to the scaling dimensions, if it were that, it would be a bonus, but it's not required for this program to make sense, I would say. Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry. You just mentioned that we only have 10 minutes more before the Pi Day talk resumes. So why don't I suggest we take the rest of the questions downstairs to Bistro, where there's some snacks, maybe. And let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.